From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
I wasn't real sure what iniquities were, but it didn't take me long to go. That was probably not something I should ask Mama.
The healthy, portly nurse at the hospital told me that she had shingles once. This meant that normal people got them. I was not different, not yet.
There was a full-scale race riot underway. And then, walking down through the middle of it all, came me.
Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
Well, finally they come down, a great mother ship, a bright light, and I thought for one split instant things are gonna be alright. They beam me straight up, Scotty, and they showed me their view, and I had a good look at them. Every little sucker looked like you. Yeah, they're out there now, and they're controlling my pen. I'm permanently out there till you come back again. A Lord, pick me up, spin around tonight and take me away. On in a planet flight, Lord, pick me up, spin me around tonight. Take me away. On in a planet flight.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Justin McGoldrick? Y'all like Justin? Born in Australia, Justin McGoldrick moved to America in 1996. He's a self-taught musician and songwriter, and he's been playing music in all genres for over 25 years, including Montgomery Trucking. He's currently fronting his band, the P47s, and recently recorded Calliope Blues, a solo album, and Little Rockette with the P47s. He has CDs for sale after the show, and you can find out more about Justin and the P47s on Facebook and Reverb Nation. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week's show is about making assumptions, and we all know what happens when people do that. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Patrice Melnick struggles with being blatantly stereotyped, and we'll end the night with Jim Fry as he turns an assumption on its head. But let's start the night with Kay Brockwell as her preacher assumes one thing when it's really another in Scuppernongs, Swimming Holes, and Scarlet Women.
One of the joys of being born when your mother is not far past 19 is that you get to grow up together. And when you grow up within shouting distance of the lake, and your mother grew up closer to the lake than that, that means you frequently dropped what you were doing when your mother called, "Hey, let's go swimming." We had several favorite swimming spots. I favored thrashing around the shallows, playing with the minnows, and finding little mussel shells, while Mama basked in an inner tube and soaked up the sun. Sometimes we'd go to the lake, race out to a close-to-shore island, pretend to be Robinson Crusoe. Other times, when it was just suffering hot in August, we'd go to the creek, where the shade and the cool water would ease away the summer heat. One afternoon, it was a lake afternoon, I was splashing about and Mama had had enough sun, and she had taken to exploring the lake bank. I heard her come back, heard the trunk open on the car, and I went to investigate. Mama was peering intently into the trunk, pawing through the assortment of junk there. She stopped, she stood back, hands on her hip, and had a disgusted look on her face. "What's the matter, Mama?" I asked. "I found a whole patch of ripe scuppernongs, and there's not a thing in here to pick them in." I scampered for the scuppernongs. It's a wild white muscadine that has an impossibly sweet taste and makes perhaps the best jelly in the world. I was busy picking scuppernongs and stuffing them into my face when Mama came marching back, broad grin on her face. Slung over her shoulder were her capri pants she had worn over her bathing suit, with knots tied in the legs. Now, Mama was not a small woman. She wasn't fat, but she wasn't small. Her capri pants had room for a significant amount of scuppernongs, and we picked them full. I could just taste scuppernong jelly on a fresh biscuit. We carefully stowed the scuppernongs in the back floorboard of the car, propped up so they wouldn't spill out of their improvised bucket, and we carefully navigated our way back up the hill from the lake bank, down the gravel road, and out onto the highway, where we promptly had a flat. Mom sat grimly behind the wheel for a moment, clad in her blouse and her Jansen and her sandals. The flat was on the driver's side, the side toward the highway. "Okay," she said, "here's what we're going to do. You get the spare and the wrench out of the trunk. When you do that, I'm going to jump out of the car and change this flat real quick." I wrestled the spare out of the trunk, rolled it to the rear. Went back for the lug wrench. Mama jumped out and commenced to spin lug nuts loose. And the preacher pulled up. "Trouble?" he asked casually, barely a glance at Mama's legs. My mama's long, tan, bare legs. "Y'all just have a seat. Let me change this tire." Mama had always been a pillar of the church. President of the Missionary Society, Sunday school teacher, organizer of potlucks, chairman of the Christmas program and food basket distribution. In those few moments, I could see that pillar swelling to Herculean proportions. I could see myself a clearer of potluck tables and a fetcher of food basket fixings for the foreseeable future. Sunday morning, I sat in our pew between Mom and Daddy. About the time the sermon started, I felt Mama tense. I reeled myself back from my daydream, and I concentrated. The preacher was talking about the woman at the well. Now, I had not gotten far enough in Sunday school to learn about the questionable provenance of the woman at the well. So I didn't really understand why Mama's frown lines appeared between her eyebrows, why her foot began tapping softly at the back of the pew in front of us, why her hand tensed up just a little on my shoulder as the preacher waxed eloquent about women and modesty and temptation and men lured to all sorts of iniquities. I wasn't real sure what iniquities were, but it didn't take me long to gather that was probably not something I should ask Mama. I was a little puzzled when she found something that needed doing in the Sunday school classroom after church, avoiding filing out through the front door and shaking the preacher's hand. And I was somewhat more puzzled when she graciously stepped back to let someone else chair the next potluck. I just knew that I wasn't bussing tables, and that was a good thing. And we made 17 pints of jelly out of those scuppernongs, and it was wonderful on a fresh biscuit, and there was always a bucket in the trunk from that day forward.
Kay Brockwell is a recycled newspaper journalist now working in economic development in Hot Springs, Arkansas. She is a Southerner and proud of it, and a Jefferson, Jackson, Roosevelt Democrat and proud of that too. In our next story, Patrice Melnick goes in for an eye exam and the conjecture begins in The Ophthalmologist.
I went to an ophthalmologist to be sure that a recent bout with shingles had not damaged my eye. I dutifully filled out the paperwork and checked off boxes regarding medical history. I paused for only a moment as I checked off the HIV box. It was a cold March day in Fairbanks, Alaska, and my parka lay wadded up on the chair beside me as I waited. "This might sting a moment," said the bald-headed, ready-faced doctor as he put drops into my eyes. "Not too uncommon for AIDS patients to get shingles." "I am not an AIDS patient," I thought. "I have HIV." In my mind, having HIV meant I had not yet become terminally ill. Shingles was not one of the opportunistic infections. I had heard of pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi sarcoma, extremely rare diseases. Regular people got shingles. The healthy, portly nurse at the hospital told me that she had shingles once. This meant that normal people got them. I was not different, not yet. It was not an opportunistic infection, therefore I did not have AIDS. I needed to believe this. I clung to the HIV definition. AIDS patient meant I belonged in a hospice, needed constant medical care, was in and out of hospitals. AIDS meant it was too late for me. My face was warm, my hands clammy. "I think of myself as having HIV," I said. "Mm-hmm," the doctor nodded. "So you got HIV from a blood transfusion?" he asked. "No." My vision grew blurry from the drops. "Wait just a minute for your eyes to dilate," the doctor said. "So not from a blood transfusion?" "No." I wondered why he asked how I had been infected and why he assumed blood transfusion. Did blood transfusion seem the most likely way in which a woman would become infected? Did he think I seemed like a nice girl and therefore couldn't have gotten HIV from sex or sharing needles? I hoped he was not trying to figure me into his assessment of guilt or innocence. I did not feel more or less guilty than anyone else. "I'll be right back," the doctor said as he walked out the door. I sat in the blue-gray room until he returned and shut off the lights. He shone a light into each eye. "So, where did you get it from?" His tone was friendly, casual. Perhaps he was just trying to make conversation. "From sex," I said. "Sex with a man." I hoped the questions would end. He projected onto the wall an eye chart. "I think I read most of the letters right." "That's fine," he said as he switched on the lights. I could hear the soft buzz of a flickering light bulb. "Do you know from who?" he asked. I couldn't figure out how to make the doctor stop asking questions without being rude. He seemed nosy, like a man that peers through the midnight bedroom window of his neighbor's house. Was he trying to figure out if I was guilty or a victim? "Got it in the Central African Republic," I said, "in the Peace Corps." I hoped he'd be satisfied. "Not too much scarring," the doctor said as he scribbled something into my chart. "Vision seems fine." "Was it from a white man or a black man?" My stomach tightened into a fist. "White or black? Good or bad?" My heart raced. I felt like the doctor had shifted me from the blood transfusion victim box to the sex guilt box, and now he was trying to figure out whether to toss me from the sex with white man box down into the sex with black man box. Was he trying to imagine scenes as though watching a movie in his mind? Was he trying to figure out if this was Sleepless in Seattle or Jungle Fever? Love story or Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? When Harry Met Sally or Zebrahead? I wondered who would play me in the love scenes. Not Julia Roberts or Meg Ryan, too glamorous. Maybe Janine Garofalo or Frances McDormand, down to earth. But the doctor was wondering who would play the male lead, Johnny Depp or Denzel Washington, Brad Pitt or Wesley Snipes, John Cusack or Samuel L. Jackson. Would there be full frontal nudity? Surely the obligatory flash of breasts. Would the actress do her own love scenes or have a double? Would there be male frontal nudity, a la Harvey Keitel the piano? But would nudity harm or help the ratings? Would the production inch into soft porn, The doctor wanted details. He wanted to see the story. People want to see the story. The public wants details, bare flesh. This was no longer a medical situation, a virus, a patient. This was skin. This was racy. This was race. But it was also about the boxes, the innocent victim box versus the got what she deserved box. And I seemed like a nice girl. I was going to graduate school. My clothes were clean, my skin pale. I spoke standard English, and I had a pretty smile in the right light, if you don't look too close. I envisioned some of my African friends. Maryam Hammat ran vividly printed meters of fabric between her fingers. Awa's slender, coffee-toned hands braided her sister's hair. The upbeat guitar solos of the Central African band Makembe played in my head. Vocal harmonies sang in my veins. The doctor's blue eyes scanned my face for an answer. "Don't see how this is relevant," I said. "Oh, of course not. Just wondering," the doctor said hastily. "Looks like your vision won't be affected, but if you have any problems, give me a call." I gathered my parka and wool hat. My palms sweated, and I felt dizzy as I hurried towards the door. I stepped out into the sharp ice Alaskan air, and the snow glare blinded me. I put on my shades and took deep breaths. I began to walk home, crunching over the snow-crusted sidewalk as a syncopated rhythm drummed inside my head.
Patrice Melnick's story, The Ophthalmologist, is from her memoir entitled Po' Boy Contraband from Catalyst Book Press. She lives in Grand Coteau, Louisiana, where she runs a gift shop and directs the Festival of Words. In our final story of the night, Jim Fry leaves all assumptions behind, not once, but twice, in Prism Riot.
It was 1952. I was a chubby 4-year-old playing in the front yard of the house that my family was renting in Clarksville, Georgia. My mom, dad, two older brothers, and I had recently moved here. The textile company my dad was employed by had relocated us to this small town in North Georgia so that he could straighten out the floundering Clarksville mills. My parents were both from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Once the whaling capital of the world, its industry was now mostly fishing and textiles. After his discharge from the Navy at the end of World War II, Dad used the GI Bill to attend textile college there. Upon graduation, he was hired by a New York-based firm, and he worked his way up to become their management troubleshooter. As a family, we were sent to any location that had a troubled mill, and once it was on an even keel, we moved again. Clarksville was the latest stop. Ours was the last house on a side street. At its end, on a small hill, was a tiny white schoolhouse. Every morning when the weather was nice, I would stand at the picket fence to watch the parade of black children heading toward their school. Now, in those days, education, as well as all aspects of society in Georgia, was very segregated. Lines were distinct and not to be crossed. But each day, those kids smiled and waved to me, a white boy, and I smiled and waved in return. One particular afternoon, a small group of the children knocked on our door and asked if I could visit their school. My mom, being a Massachusetts Yankee, unencumbered by racial prejudice, saw no reason to refuse. I doubt she hesitated, as she seldom did, before saying yes. The next morning, I eagerly awaited their arrival. That same group collected me, held both my hands, and walked me down the street, up the hill. Inside, there was one room filled with old desks. Across the front was a large blackboard upon which the teacher showed me how to write my name and the numbers 1 to 10. I stayed with them all day, at the end of which the children walked me home, hugged me, and went on their way. 15 years later, the driver's expression was noticeably grim as he considered my request. I had asked for my usual transfer ticket for the second bus, which would take me closer to my workplace. A soon-to-be sophomore at a small college in North Carolina, I was earning money for next year's expenses, working as a laborer in a retail sales warehouse. It was a nondescript brick building in a predominantly African-American, or black as was correct for the times, section of Newark, New Jersey. The date was July 14, 1967. "I can give you a transfer," he said, "but that bus is only going two blocks, then turning around on account of the fires." Now, I was taught at an early age that if you have a job, you do it. No excuses. I figured if the bus couldn't get me there, I'd have to find my own way around the fires. So at the end of those two blocks, I exited the bus and set off on foot toward Elizabeth Avenue, thinking it probably wasn't much over a mile to the warehouse. The morning was already hot, and I wished I had been wearing my work clothes instead of a suit. But that evening, I would be taking the train to my family's summer cottage in Massachusetts. Rather than wrinkling my Sunday suit, I had chosen to wear it while carrying my old jeans and shirt in a paper grocery sack. As I reached Elizabeth Avenue and began walking down it, I got a better understanding of the fires. There was a full-scale race riot underway. Most store windows were shattered, and there was glass everywhere. Security gratings were torn off of buildings and thrown onto the sidewalk or out into the street. Buildings were ablaze. There were no vehicles moving, and hundreds of people were milling around. Many of them were going into the vandalized stores, coming out carrying every conceivable article: clothes, appliances, jewelry, food, booze. It was all leaving the now wide open stores and pawn shops. The only intact windows and doors were those which had "Soul Brother" painted on them, as if marked with sheep's blood during a biblical plague. And then, walking down through the middle of it all, came me. A dirty blonde-haired 19-year-old wearing a blue suit and clutching a brown paper bag. One white face on a maelstrom of brown and black, adrift in its innocence. Very strange. Almost surreal. As I passed through the crowd, a few people paused in their looting to stare. Simply because of their skin color, these people had suffered repression, while I had been granted privilege. Their anger at that injustice was now spilling all over that debris-strewn avenue. Groups of young and old, standing on street corners, followed my progress with slowly swiveling heads, as traffic lights needlessly maintained their rhythm. I've always been one to look people in the eye, and what I saw on that hot summer day was a mixture of hostility, fear, and bewilderment. No one said a word to me, nor made a threatening move. Some totally ignored me. Most watched my passing as if viewing an apparition from some alternate universe. My presence there must have been as much a puzzlement to them as it was to me. When I reached the warehouse, its steel door was locked tight. I banged on it until someone looked out the peephole, opened the door, and quickly pulled me inside. "What the devil are you doing here? We don't even want to be out there." It was Willis, a tall, proud, erect, muscular black man whom I liked and admired. "Just trying to get to work," I answered, while knowing how lame that sounded. Willis shook his head and said, "Well, we're locking it all down till this is over, and you're going home." Then Willis and Abe, the warehouse foreman, secured the building and deadbolted the door. Driving back up Elizabeth Avenue in the company vehicle, we passed several Army deuce-and-a-half trucks coming in with the canvas down and beds full of National Guardsmen. They were holding rifles with fixed bayonets. It would be a violent, destructive weekend in Newark. Way back in 1952, my encounter as a four-year-old with those open-hearted black children had seemed perfectly natural. But looking back through the lens of time and experience, I've come to realize that I was probably the first, if not only, white kid to attend an all-Negro school in Habersham County, possibly in all of Georgia. I am proud to have been an inadvertent early pioneer of desegregation in the Deep South. And maybe a rainbow thread, a lifeline of understanding, compassion, and respect from that Georgia schoolhouse fell through a wormhole in space and time to wrap around the hearts of those brothers and sisters who witnessed my solitary hike down riot-torn Elizabeth Avenue 15 years later. Was I being protected by angels? Yes. Were they white or black? No doubt they were both. Otherwise, I would probably have died in the Newark riot in July 1967. At least 26 people did, and well over 700 were injured. I am 64 years of age now, transplanted from North Carolina to the Arkansas Ozarks in 1976. Since that morning in Newark, I've worked every job from lifeguard to pipeliner, drywall finisher to farm laborer, census taker to convenience store manager, and have encountered people of every race. Through the passing years, my memory has often returned me to those two defining days in a long life. I can still see the look in the eyes of those who watched me walk down Elizabeth Avenue, just as I can still see the faces and hear the chatter of those young African-American students as they led me to their humble schoolhouse. And I believe that somehow these two separate events are closely connected to who I was back then, who I was to become later, and who I am today. A person who sees skin color but realizes it is only that, the pigmentation of a package within which is contained a unique gift. The value of that gift, like a book, should never be judged by its cover. We are all born where we are born. We go where we go, and inside each of us is the person we choose to be. Such is life, and such is one life story, painted in black and white. Thank you, and have peace.
Born in the North, raised in the South, Jim Fry lives in Madison County, Arkansas. A semi-retired sales consultant, he writes and records children's stories and does storytelling in schools through the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.